Welcome to episode 6 of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast with your co-host, me, Eric Drysdale.
And I'm Jared Hunter.
In today's episode, we're going to be reviewing some of the political developments that have happened in Canada and abroad while we have not been podcasting for the last several months. And so there's a lot to talk about. And so with that, I'll hand it over to Jared to introduce our first topic for today.
One of the big topics in Canada right now was since the most recent federal election in which the Liberals had won a minority government, the Conservative Party, which is the second largest party, their leader, Andrew Scheer, has formally resigned. And so they are in the midst of another leadership candidate race. And at the moment, there are four people in the running. Peter MacKay and Aaron O'Toole are the two front runners. Then there's also Leslyn Lewis. And then there's also Derek Sloan. Recently, there was a debate, the leadership debate for this Conservative Party. And that was a couple of weeks ago. But I thought we would start off with, like, what are some of the main platforms? What were some of the big issues that we think are kind of defining this Conservative race? And that's not necessarily even what will be the issues that would make or break the general election, but what are probably, I think, the defining characteristics that the rank and file kind of Conservative members that are voting are actually making their decisions on. I think one of the big ones, and this is more because it was touted as one of the weaknesses when Andrew Scheer was running against the Liberals in the most recent federal election, was their lack of a climate change plan. Basically, their entire plan was, we're going to scrap the carbon tax that exists, and then we'll just see what happens. And they received a lot of criticism for that. And I think there has been kind of an effort, at least on the part of like Peter MacKay and Aaron O'Toole, to come up with a bit of a response to that. But it doesn't matter who you vote for, all of them will scrap the carbon tax. That is a given. Peter MacKay, he had one of the kind of most concise parts of this. They're going to cut the carbon tax, and then they want to push Canadian sources of energy because they hope that it will offset carbon offsets or carbon emissions of other countries. Basically pushing natural gas as a replacement for coal-fired power plants in other countries. I don't know how likely it is that someone could actually kind of keep this type of a promise. It A, depends on the decisions of political leaders in other countries. So this seems like a weird tack to me.
So I completely agree that everybody, whether you're conservative or not, agreed that the Conservative Party did not have a serious climate change plan. And for those conservatives that think that was a good idea last election, they would say as well, climate change is an issue, but it's really not anywhere near the top. So, you know, we're glad we're not, you know, dealing with taxing hardworking Canadians. We're focusing on real issues. So that's what the partisans would have said. And to your point, currently, I mean, you have to score them at a D, best case a C minus, an improvement on the Scheer plan. I mean, there is still absolutely nothing. Like it is talk about like magical. Ironically, it kind of reminds me of carbon offsetting. So instead of buying a forest somewhere in Brazil and saying we're carbon net zero, now they're saying it's like, well, actually, we're going to build a pipeline to BC, and then we're going to offset coal plants that would have existed in China or India.
Now,
it's not to say that it's not an intellectually valid point on some level, but it's a complete joke of a plan because no country or stakeholder thinks that that is actually a way to reduce emissions.
And well, it's not really Canada's reduction in emissions then, right? That's India and China's reduction in emissions. So what are you doing about us?
And conservatives are right to make fun of Trudeau and other liberals who would fly around the world and then buy like these goofy carbon offsets and say like, oh, well, you know, we saved carbon that would have been emitted, so it's all out in the wash. I think they're right to make fun of that. And ironically, they're doing the same thing with these goofy ideas of changing kind of the energy mix, basically, of other countries. And on top of that, the few times that Peter MacKay has signaled something that sounds more credible, so he made reference on his website or somewhere, I can't remember, to the the acid rain environmental program in the 1980s and 90s as something to do, but that is a cap and trade system. I remember us talking about that in our environmental economics class, and Peter McKay has explicitly said that there will be no pricing of carbon. So I don't know what he thinks he's taking from that plan, because if you don't have a price on carbon, you can't really hope to reduce emissions in any serious sense.
Yeah. I mean, so I kind of sympathize. They're kind of in a bit of a bind, right? Like, they need to win the votes of the rank and file conservative base, where like a majority of those people don't think they need to do anything for climate change, or let's say a significant number, because I don't have the polling data. So I can't necessarily say a majority of conservative members actually don't believe in climate change or think that there shouldn't be anything done. And so they're all in this kind of position where, you know, once the general election comes around, you're going to have some kind of a platform. And for it to be a credible platform, it has to be around for a while. But if you have anything that's kind of a credible plan, you're going to alienate that core constituency of voters within the Conservative Party. And so you may not be able to get the leadership. So they're really in this kind of catch-22, I think, here.
But there is a more intelligent political out. So what if you're someone like Peter McKay, I think what you should be doing is you say something like, I will absolutely not support a carbon tax. And then what you let yourself have is the ability to have other indirect forms of pricing, whether it's some sort of quota or whether it's some sort of like agreement with like the top producers, which is a less efficient economic mechanism, but it doesn't matter. You basically give yourself that out. And then what you do is you say something like, whatever my plan is, it won't be a tax on Canadians and it will lead to a 10% reduction in carbon. And so what you do is you say is like, I will commit myself to reducing carbon. This is the difference, is that none of them have done that. And so that when you actually get elected, you can basically say anything you're doing is to get to that quantitative reduction you have promised. So if you say, actually, we're going to green light two like micronuclear reactors in these like sites, that you didn't think I was going to do that. Well, I don't care, because I said I was going to get a 10% reduction by not using a carbon tax, and that's what I'm doing. So, you know, like I just came up with this in the last 30 seconds. Like, you know, this isn't like rocket science here. So I really think there is a better political strategy here. I think it's just really like a lack of, I just don't think they care. I don't think any of these guys like actually think that climate change is a problem.
I think it's interesting that you did bring up actually the nuclear energy, because that's one of my favorite parts of Aaron O'Toole's climate plan, is that he wants to export nuclear technology to other countries. To me, that just strikes me as very strange, only because of the stereotype of the right-wing conservative being terrified of giving nuclear technology to any other countries. And so there in his platform, one of the main ways that he wants to fight climate change is to give nuclear technology to these countries. Yeah, there's these kind of loops, these hoops that they are trying to jump through, I think. What was the other one that he had? Actually, I think I remember reading it on Leslyn Lewis's page. It was most prominent, actually. Her plan was to basically clean up orphan wells in Alberta. And so that was like her plan of like putting money into the energy sector by paying these people to clean up these orphan wells that are like these abandoned sites that need to get, like, they're an environmental hazard, put people in Alberta back to work, that gets more energy into the or more money into the energy sector. And that kind of has some green credits associated with it. It doesn't necessarily get at the root issue of like climate change, but it's an interesting thing to have as like your environmental headstone, you know?
Yeah, so what they have done a good job of doing is basically saying, it's like, we're actually like really good on the environment for everything other than climate change. Like they've all basically said, like, you know, we're going to, depending on the candidates, or not all the candidates have said this, like various things, like we're going to increase preservation of lakes or increase like the size of parks and clean air, clean water, like, and they're touting Brian Mulroney's environmental record as a precedent for how conservatives can be environment friendly, and that's all fine. But if I was running, I would have a quantitative like target, basically say like, you know, unlike the liberals who focus on how much they're going to tax you, I'm going to focus on how much I'm actually going to reduce carbon emissions. So you can score some cheap points there. And then you can espouse two conservative principles. You can say there are roughly, I don't know the number, say roughly 60 to 75% of like Canadian economic activity occurs in areas that will not never have hydroelectric power channeled to them because there aren't those things there. And what we're going to do is completely phase out all coal and eventually natural gas with a nuclear reactor or something like that. We're going to shift the energy mix to nuclear in order to reduce the 10% target. And then like, what are you going to criticize me on? Because I'm getting to the Paris target, right? And we know this would actually work, because if you look at Western Europe, the country with if I told you the per capita emissions of France, Britain, Sweden, and Germany, which country has the lowest per capita emissions?
Well, I kind of know, because I'm going to say France, because of their nuclear power.
That's the only reason why, right? Even though Germany has the largest renewable energy mix in all of Western Europe, it doesn't matter, because they're offsetting it with gas and coal production. Anyways, this is all to say is that there are ways to be conservative and to target a quantitative reduction in carbon emissions. And lastly, I'm going to probably bring up this topic in most of our political discussions, but the final conservative method is to say, basically, by building more urban and dense housing in Canada's like most economically dynamic cities, we just also reduce emissions by automatic changes in lifestyle independent of any government policy. So two things: quantitative target with nuclear energy and a focus on building housing in Canada's like overheated housing market. Like, those seem like easy conservative wins.
I agree with you from the kind of intellectual side of like a conservative viewpoint, though. But I think that it's more the practicalities of the politics that they can't really bring those up. And that's because if they start saying, oh, we're going to give housing credits to urban people or people that live in cities, and we're going to make housing cheaper in cities, all their voters live in rural counties. They're going to say, well, you're supposed to be representing me. You're my party. Why are you giving money to people that live in cities? So I don't think that would fly at all. That would even be something I think that other candidates could pillory you if you had that in your platform.
You have to be careful. I agree that you don't come across sounding like that. So what you actually make it clear as you're saying is like, look, some places in Canada, because it's cold and it's rural, it's like you just need to produce more carbon emissions because that's where you live, right? And I'm going to say, as a conservative, I'm going to protect you from Trudeau's tax hike. And the way I'm going to do that is by not taxing you and instead getting urban people to reduce carbon emissions further. So you can keep doing what you're doing. Don't worry. Like, other sectors are basically cross-subsidizing you. That's effectively what you're saying.
The next one that I really see is kind of defining this conservative leadership race, at least from my point of view. Obviously, all of these things that I'm bringing up are a bit biased. They're from how I've been observing it. But this was one that I thought was even just surprising to come back, was how prevalent abortion has been in kind of even the leadership debates.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's really been because of Derek Sloan's candidacy and him being a staunch, staunch pro-lifer.
And Leslyn Lewis.
I think Leslyn Lewis has, I mean, I don't know. I saw it as she tried to distance herself a bit from Derek in the debates, and reading over her platform, which I know many people don't actually read all the platforms line by line, but in Leslyn Lewis's platform, all of her stances were basically making it illegal to force a woman to have an abortion. I don't know how you actually find laws that would do that and not have some other kind of side effect.
but Jared, sorry, let me just jump in quick. Like, what that is basically saying, I'm guessing, is what she's saying is there are immigrant communities that are forcing mothers to have an abortion, because what I know for a fact is in Lewis's platform is a banning of sex selective abortions. So I think those two policies are like coupled together. Like, that's what the implication is.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not, like, to me, that's not necessarily a staunch pro-life standpoint. And so I think that there's a real distinction between where Derek Sloan stands and where Leslyn Lewis stands. And an argument coming from, like, Leslyn Lewis with, let's make kind of these tweaks, to me would have seemed like, that seems like a fair conservative candidate's viewpoint to come in. Whereas Derek being just like, no, this should be illegal again, that was just so from left field. Like, I thought in Canada, the debate over abortion was settled and that we dealt with this and we'd moved on. And that was even something that really hurt Andrew Scheer, the worries about his stance on abortion. Now, maybe Derek Sloan isn't really planning on winning the leadership. I mean, it seems incredibly unlikely that he will, but it's just trying to push the socially conservative platform so that it's more prevalent. Maybe. I mean, it's worrisome that it's that is something that's happening for anyone that's pro-choice, at least.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, which is that the Conservative Party has slowly been migrating away from a pro-life party to one that allows pro-life members, but has basically explicitly told them that they will never have any legislative agenda. And so what all the other candidates bicker about, the mainstream bickering, is whether or not we allow Conservative Party members to basically openly dissent against abortion laws. Yep. And like Peter McKay and Aaron O'Toole say that's fine. I know.
Though that was a change for Peter McKay. He initially was a hard against any member voting their conscience, and has had to walk that back to be more similar to Aaron O'Toole.
And that stuff, though, is like just marginal stuff. It doesn't really matter. And the bottom line is that what matters is like the cabinet level. And so both, like, Peter McKay basically says, like, of course, like, you have to whip the cabinet vote in a parliamentary system. Yes. You can't have dissenting cabinet views, because then you shouldn't be in the cabinet. Yeah, I don't, like, again, the issues around abortion scare tactics used by the left against the conservatives have historically, well, by historically, I mean in the last like two elections, I'm not speaking about 2001, have been completely unfounded. Now, that's not to say that I blame someone for not wanting to have a person in power who privately wishes abortion were legal. Like, I can see why you would feel uncomfortable with that, but like, it is disingenuous to have ever suggested that the legislative agenda by the conservatives would have prevented abortion. We're kind of getting into the weeds here. You could imagine policies on the margin, such as foreign aid funding for abortion, or certain like doctors having rights to not practice certain procedures. These are all things that would be debated, but there was no mainstream movement. Now, and I think you're right, though, Derek Sloan has brought back a very hardline view that has been absent at the top of the Conservative Party for many years.
If Derek Sloan were to become the leader of the Conservative Party, then there's now going from, this is a scare tactic of the left, to being a legitimate concern for someone that's on the pro-life side.
Yes, yeah, sorry, that was the conclusion of my point side. That I forgot I forgot to actually mention, was that it now actually would be true. It is the official policy.
I think it's fairly safe to say that more Canadians are on the pro-choice side than on the pro-life side. And so if they start taking a harder pro-life stance, I think that could hurt them in any kind of general election.
No, but here's a question for you, is suppose that Peter McKay becomes the leader. Does Derek Sloan bringing back a hardline stance, like, within the base, does that impact Peter McKay? Like, can the Liberals use that against him somehow, that a failed candidate had these views? I don't know.
Yeah. So that's where I think that if someone like Peter McKay, who was able to basically say, look, no, this was over, no one in the cabinet is going to be able to vote pro-life. If you want to vote your conscience and you're some backbench or whatever, that will certainly soften the stick that the Liberals will have. I think it's more, I'm bringing it up as like this kind of long-term view in like, what is the kind of distribution shift of Conservative Party members and the views that they want expressed, right? And if that kind of socially conservative base becomes more and more powerful within the Conservative Party, I could see them losing power in the general elections.
Yeah. I have a couple. So first, I want to make a statement about that. And then I want to follow up by a question, which is just bringing back they asked them in the debate, like, what do we need to do to grow the party? And so I think this is relevant to that. Mm. But first, the statement about the distribution shift, you know, I'm not exactly sure that there has been a shift in the party. I think historically, Canada's Conservative Party has been unique in its ability to prevent grassroots views from percolating to the top. Like, in other words, it is a very like tight cylinder, and the crazies, so to speak, are kept out. And it's been a very impressive balancing act, especially since the Conservative Party united, thanks to Peter McKay. But yeah, and I think what it is just now with like certain alt-right movements, Derek Sloan is now empowered to take those views which exist and give them more voice. And so we're seeing, like, with outlets like Rebel Media and True North, so there now are like far-right news outlets that really didn't exist in Canada before. And that's probably going to basically allow at least one member to always run in the Conservative Party, because they're now media outlets that basically propagate their message across the Conservative base. So they're always going to have a minimum like viability for fundraising and certain numbers of votes. So that is a concerning development, but one that can be managed, but it's no doubt real.
So I wonder then, what if, and here we'll put our tinfoil hats on, what if this is really, they put Derek Sloan in as a vent for the socially conservative voters, that they can see there was a candidate for the leadership race that they can vote and they can put their backing behind. But then that basically allows those socially conservative active political members to stay engaged with the Conservative Party instead of going to the Wexit Party now, or going to some third party splinter that would be much more hardline pro-life maybe. And so this is their kind of like a pressure release method just to keep that big blue tent big.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that all effective organizations have to have some pressure release mechanism for views that don't win. Like, you have to keep the coalition together. And so there's always that balancing act. So both Leslyn Lewis and Sloan have said that they are upset with the way the Conservative Party even allows people to run for the party. There were at least one person who was basically not allowed to even run, like independent of getting a certain fundraising and signatures and things like that. Right. And so, yeah, the Conservative Party by definition already has various filter mechanisms, and maybe this is an effective one. And it should be said that even for people on the left who find these views abhorrent, and many people that are conservatives do too, you do need some pressure release mechanisms. Otherwise, you will get the People's Party in power, or with seats, that is to say. Like, you do right. need occasionally to feed the hungry dogs. So that's just a fact of politics.
Which is what Derek Sloan is that meat to the social conservatives, I guess. Bit of a crude analogy.
So let me just then go to the thing that I brought up, which is that in the debate, they asked them, like, how are the conservatives going to win, and how are you going to basically expand the party? So I thought that was a really interesting question. And basically, the breakdown of responses, the way I remember them, were Erin O'Toole said, we need to grow the suburban and urban vote, which makes sense. And he says, I'm the best one to do that because I was elected in the GTA, and he made this statement about at least 50 times in the debate. he's from Durham. I looked it up where his seat is. He's not. Yeah. He's on the outskirts of the GTA, but whatever. And then Peter McKay gave kind of vague statements about unity in a big tent. And basically, I think, ironically, McKay's thing was almost like a Trudeau sort of play of this idea of like a unifying leader, which is fine. And he mentioned that he's from Atlantic Canada too. Leslyn Lewis and Derek Sloan in their own ways basically said that we need to be authentic conservatives. Basically, we need to, now Derek Sloan had a much more unabashed way of putting it, but that's basically what they were saying, is like, people won't vote for us if they know that we're being phony. Basically, you have, in some sense, kind of three ideas there about how the conservatives will grow. So, Jared, what do you think about those three ideas for growing the Conservative Party, if you were a conservative?
So if I was a conservative and literally just strategizing, I would say I have the rural vote locked down, and what's closest to that is probably just go for the suburban vote. And I would say I don't know if Aaron O'Toole is the best choice for that, even though that's what he claims to be. Because I see Peter McKay as really able to get those kind of swing liberal voters because he's very safe. He's an old name. He was one of the people that were very influential back when they united the whole party. He was influential under Harper. And so a lot of those suburban voters could come back to that kind of familiar face, I think. Whereas Aaron O'Toole, I think he's gone a bit away from being the best candidate for that. And I think because of a different strategy of how he's going to win the leadership race. And I think that's, he's trying to be the second choice for the social conservatives before McKay. And so it'll be kind of like what happened with the last leadership race, where it would be kind of the same situation where there was Maxime Bernier won in the first round, but then lost in the last round. And that could be Aaron O'Toole's path into the leadership. And so I think there has been some rhetoric that's come out of him that's put him in between Peter McKay and Leslie Lewis and Derek Sloan to be that second choice for those socially conservative voters. But that being said, being closer to Peter McKay is better for the general election because I think he's got a better chance for those suburban votes.
Okay. So let me focus in on that. So like to the point of you go for the suburban votes, that's a viable strategy for the conservatives, but maybe actually O'Toole isn't the right person for that. But actually, I think on a deeper level, just ignore who the candidates are running right now. Like if you could basically pick anyone from the Conservative Party to kind of meet this criterion, I think there are kind of three ways you can win elections in a first past the post system relative to if you're benchmarking yourself to a last election. The one is to win seats that had a close margin. So that's the suburban strategy. The second approach is to think not in terms of, like, say, even necessarily swing seats or urban versus suburban divide versus rural, but actually more geographic. So more like, we know that we've been able to win 20 seats in Quebec before. Last election, we won 5. So in principle, we know Quebec is up for grabs, even if we lost by a big margin. And then lastly, there's an approach which is, and I don't think this really works for the conservatives, but it is one that you can claim, which is there are actually large numbers of people that don't vote. And that if we could win them over, we could actually increase the voter base. And so, for example, there are like at least 20 to 50 ridings where if First Nations voted at national averages, they would basically decide the vote, which is, I'm just giving one interesting example of community and politics of reasons why people say that First Nations might be like a silent kind of voting swinger. So I think the conservatives, I actually don't know if I even agree with the first one. I think the second one might be a slightly better way of thinking about it because regional politics tends to be how Canada works. And the times that the conservatives have won big majority, it's not usually been because like, we've won Van South and Durham again, but it's actually, it's like, you know what, actually like we basically came to an alliance with the Quebec nationalists. So that's how Mulroney won I don't know. I actually think that a geographic play might be better. And regardless, that leads you back to Peter McKay. Because whether you think that if you want to win the suburban vote, O'Toole's not really going to do it. And if you want to win the geographies you need, again, I think, well, Peter McKay is definitely the choice for the Atlantics, which the conservatives were well below historic average in the last election, and possibly Quebec. But to be honest, I don't know the relative merits of Aaron versus Peter in Quebec.
Honestly, my impression would have been that Quebec's almost off limits for the conservatives just because the Bloc is so resurgent. That it wasn't necessarily the Liberals that really lost out with the resurgent Bloc. It was the Conservative Party. And I think Yves-François Blanchet, his party is very strong right now. And I don't think, like, they've dropped a little bit, like they're second place now in popularity polls compared to the Liberals in Quebec. But I think that's with like the COVID bump, you know, the kind of crisis bump, whoever's in power, they tend to get the credit for things going fairly well. So I would say regionally, I guess you've convinced me going regionally was probably better than just suburban across the country. I would say, let's not try for Quebec though. Try for the 905 again, try for Atlantic Canada. Those seem to be the weakest points in the Liberal coalition.
That's a happy middle ground, because you're both combining geography with urbanization. So that's good. What was interesting, I thought, was when they asked them about systemic racism, which the debates happened on June 20th, which was right around George Floyd and all these various things, and the RCMP commissioner and things like that. And they all gave slightly different answers. So Derek Sloan, unsurprisingly, basically said systemic racism doesn't exist, because he defined it as any law which basically prejudices one group or person. So there's no laws in Canada that exist, so we can't be systemically racist. Although, and let's tie this back to Quebec as a footnote later, he said the one exception to that might be Bill 21 in Quebec. But okay, putting that aside. Erin O'Toole would not say that there was systemic racism, but he said that there was racism. But he didn't want to basically talk about the idea of systemically racist. Peter McKay said that there was, and he came across as like a little woke. Like, he talked about like some of the racial injustices in Nova Scotia, where the Black Americans, British subjects, went after the Revolutionary War, and the racism that was like even around in his childhood. So he gave a kind of a good kind of historical overview of racist heritage that could lead to systemic racism. And then very surprisingly, like, Leslyn Lewis gave like the most comprehensive and contemporary answer you would expect, basically said, like, if there are discrepancies in outcomes within institutional processes, that is systemic racism. Now, on its face, that almost sounds like different outcomes is bad, which is a very unconservative thing to say. But she's not a politician, so she's not used to like being nuanced about her statements. And when you actually drill down to what she meant, she gave the example of like, if two people are charged for identical crimes and there's a statistical difference in the rates of actual like jail sentencing, then that's an example of systemic racism. So she said that First Nations serve longer sentences for the same crimes. So I like thinking about systemic racism on like a statistical level, which is if you control for every observable covariate and like a race covariate is still statistically relevant, then that suggests that there's some systemic bias. So I thought the range of answers was interesting. And one thing that this race is dominated by is they all seem to have kind of very similar answers on many things, or there's a clear split between Sloan versus the rest. And this one, there was a lot more like of a gradient. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I do remember, actually, I was very surprised with Leslyn Lewis's answer, and even thought that it was like a fairly good answer, like to be able to control for equal input to be the same output, or same actions of an individual, same sentence. That seems like a very rational and reasonable thing to want to align for us in this society. I guess the talk about this almost doesn't matter, though, unfortunately, just because I don't think it's going to be a defining issue for anyone who's a member of the Conservative Party for how they're voting. Or there will be some, but it won't be a large enough percentage of those people that it'll even get there very much airtime. Like, I don't think there has been much talk about it since the debates from any of the candidates that I've been aware of. Once the leadership debate is over, then I can see it being an issue come the general election, or even something that they will have to fend off as soon as there is a leader that the Liberals and the NDP and the Greens and the Bloc will all be targeting. I could see Peter McKay or Erin O'Toole, or on the slim chance one of the other two win, completely reforming their opinion after having won the leadership race, and so they don't have to necessarily fend off attackers from within their own party.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the implications are only for the general election, but I think this one could be a real stupid move if O'Toole comes across as insensitive and uncaring for no gain. So the carbon issue is actually a real conundrum, in the sense is that depending if you come across as too, we'll say, left-wing on the issue, you would seriously lose conservative votes. But it would be hard to imagine O'Toole saying something that the conservatives say, like, oh, this guy is too woke for me, I'm not going to vote for him. But the opposite seems like quite a risk. So I think if he's listening to our sixth podcast, I think he should definitely take that to heart if he ends up being the leader. One other thing I wanted to talk about too, the other big kind of theme that really emerged in this debate that I was quite excited by, as I've mentioned before, that I'm quite interested in foreign policy in terms of platforms, although the Canadian public generally doesn't care, but there was a lot of foreign policy stuff and a very clear hawkish nationalistic policy. So I can't remember if it was PMAC or Aaron O'Toole that said, we want free trade for free countries. So basically implying that this idea of...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was O'Toole.
That was O'Toole, yeah. But one got the sense that Peter McKay was completely on board with it. And Peter McKay, on his website, basically explicitly endorses industrial policy, which basically means government subsidizing or actively pursuing policies that encourage domestic manufacturing. And all of them supported on the stage, basically reshoring supply chains of critical infrastructure. The free trade conservatism is not dead the way it was for Trump. This is more of a selective free trade. We want free trade for the countries we like, but otherwise we're going to be quite hawkish towards those countries we aren't. And again, all of them basically said that we will restrict foreign investment in the country. And again, I never remember if it was Peter McKay or Aaron O'Toole, because on this, they all seem the same. It said, like, I will basically use Canada's Foreign Investment Review boards to block any state-owned enterprise from buying like large shares in things.
Yeah.
I think
historically that's already happened a few times. Was it the potash purchase from Saskatchewan? That was a critical infrastructure.
But this is like a very clear statement in a way that certainly the Liberal Party is not saying. This is like a very strong economic division between the conservatives and the liberals, because every candidate basically supports this. So they're all going to someone's going to bring that policy to the national stage, regardless of who it is, which I think is exciting, because I think there will be, you know, significant debates about, like, how does Canada want to structure economic relations with countries that might have hostile geopolitical intentions towards us, aka China and Russia.
I think it's interesting, like, this was kind of the conservatives' approach as, like, this is what we need to change now that we've had this pandemic. Why are our N95 masks being made in China? Why is our ventilators being made in China? Why are these critical medical supplies made somewhere else that we cannot use them for ourselves anymore? That is, I think, the biggest concern when people were hearing the news from COVID. If you were a member of the Conservative Party, you were very likely to say, why aren't we making our own masks? And there's one other distinction between how they're phrasing this versus Donald Trump. Both of them are like, we want to restrict trade, except they're much more selective of historical allies of the West that they want to trade with. Whereas Trump, he would have claimed that Canada was taking advantage of the United States just as likely as China was taking advantage of the United States. He didn't want trade with anybody. And so I think that this kind of approach really is the best of both worlds, because you're restricting trade. Anyone that just doesn't like trade and thinks all trade is bad sees that as a good thing. Anyone who sees it as a more nuanced argument can make the argument. If there was a study recently, and I say recently as in like 3 or 4 years ago, that I've a thought experiment in economics about two countries, though one having like drastically lower development in terms of like education for individuals and another country that had much higher, where they found that the roughly kind of short term, so maybe over the first couple of decades, maybe 3 decades, people in the richer country, when they opened up free trade, especially in that lower middle class, could be much worse off because of that initial out competition by those people in the less developed countries for jobs that don't necessarily need that much skill, but were getting paid a lot in the much more developed country. If you do open up trade with other countries of a similar development level or similar minimum wage, similar, I guess, economic distribution maybe is a good way to put it, then that could potentially circumvent that problem, but still you would get some of those benefits of free trade.
Yeah, yeah. There's a nice coincidence for them, which is our allies also tend to be rich. So, yeah. Right? So it's a nice correlation for them. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jared, but in our previous chats, both on and offline, like, I've noticed, I think you're generally more skeptical of trade than I am. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I don't think it's hard to be more skeptical of trade than you.
But you're more concerned about basically the economic impacts on blue collar and lower skilled workers from trade.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I'm really not as much. So, but the fact that we can both think this policy is good, because for me, I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe there's some economic costs, but I'm really more concerned about basically China using trade as a method to blackmail us. So I'm more concerned about the foreign policy implications of this, and you're more concerned about, like, hey, this actually might create some remake some manufacturing in Canada, so both people can come out kind of happy.
Yeah. To me, the problem with the trade has always been how rapid the change is. It takes place too fast for a generational shift. And so all of a sudden you have a lot of unemployment and a lot of these kind of smaller manufacturing towns in the States that made a decent wage because there wasn't very many low-skilled laborers, all of a sudden getting outcompeted really rapidly. And that happened in Canada as well. I think I agree with you that in the long term, so many efficiency gains from trade that you can't ignore it. But how fast these developed nations open up can cause that kind of short-term pain that can be a lot of turmoil.
Yeah, no, I definitely have sympathy with the point. And I don't have as strong of views of trade or not trade as you might think, but that's neither here nor there. We're talking about the political implications of these.
Yeah, we've digressed a little bit here.
So Jared, do you think that we're done talking about the Conservative Party? Because there's a final thing I want to do if we are.
There was one other topic that I did want to bring up.
Okay.
I do think that the stance on China is going to be, this is a big pivot point, I think, for the Conservative Party. Now, like, I don't think Harper was never...
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah.
So Harper, during the primaries and the early part of his leadership, basically had quite an anti-China policy, in contrast to the clearly pro-China policy of the Chrétien-Martin era. And he famously said, like, we're not going to put Canadian foreign policy at the altar of the mighty dollar, basically saying, like, I actually care about human rights and things that aren't dollars and cents. But within a few years, he did begin to change when he realized the huge trade opportunities with China. And he softened his stance on that we're going to criticize their human rights record at every time we can, sort of. So there was an evolution of Harper. That's all I want to say on that.
Okay. So, I mean, perhaps then I'm interpreting it as a new change, but maybe it's a return to the mean for the Conservative Party, in that there is a lot of anti-China rhetoric going around. And I mean, I think it's understandable. I think there's a lot of anti-China sentiments in Canada right now, with the two Michaels being seemingly arbitrarily detained in China. And
they're hostages.
Essentially, yeah. I think it's hard to have a reasonable argument saying that they're not hostages. In any case, this is a dramatic shift, I think, in the political landscape for Canada, where, yeah, everybody is anti-China. And so this has become a sticking point of, like, how do we handle this from a foreign policy standpoint, especially now that a lot of our technology is getting made there.
Yeah. And like, I assume you agree that basically all candidates, I didn't get any sense that one candidate was more anti-China than the other. There was kind of a uniformity in the hostility towards China. Why this is interesting, in the same way the foreign policy is, again, this will be a marked difference with the Liberal Party. So I'm not an expert on the Liberal Party now, like what the distribution of China sentiment is, but if there is a pro-China party in Canada, it is the Liberal Party. There have been members that are explicitly pro-China that come from Sino relations, think tanks that are like part of like the Chinese business kind of relationship establishment. And there's clearly a split in the Liberal Party about how they want to approach China, especially with the long legacy of Trudeau Senior being the first Western country to create political relations with the Communist Party. So there's like a long history there. And the one sense I do have is that within the Liberal Party, Freeland is on the anti-China side, and she's basically been critical of like China's human rights abuses, as opposed to some of the other members. So this will be quite interesting to see how the Liberals respond to the Conservatives' attack. So will they do the approach that, for example, the Conservatives do when the Liberals attack them on abortion, which is basically to say nothing and say, like, you exaggerate our view, like, we don't have that. We support Canada's values. Or will they come out and basically say, like, the Conservatives are trying to foment anti-Chinese rhetoric? that will be quite interesting to see what they do. And I think later we'll talk about some of the other Chinese relations with isn't Canada later in the episode. But yeah, I agree. This is very interesting.
Well, and we're already seeing, like, there's visible divisions within the Liberal Party now. There was a vote in the House yesterday. Two dissenting Liberal backbenchers voted against the pro-China platform, I guess, put forward by Trudeau. I don't know that much about what the actual vote was, because what I think is more interesting is that there were Liberal Party members that ended up basically voting against what Trudeau and his cabinet had put forward. That was on an explicitly, they are anti-China, and they thought that this platform or this policy was too pro-China. And I think that this is kind of the sticking point that is going to be a problem for the Liberals. How they've handled this Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig, the case, this has been a real foreign policy kind of disaster for them, especially because the wife of one of the Michaels has come out and talked about how we should just give Meng Wanzhou back. And so you have that kind of really pulling at the heartstrings of Canadians, I think, even though I guess like the Liberals are really taking what might have been a conservative approach of being, or what's seen as a right-wing approach, as saying we don't negotiate with hostage takers. I think this will be a real sticking point. And whatever they do here, the conservatives will be able to beat them with this and say, look, you're too pro-Beijing. Look at what they've done to our citizens. This is terrible. How can you be a leader of Canada?
And while the NDP and the Green Party will not have the reasons for being anti-China that the conservatives have, they have their own reasons for being anti-China, which involve the environment and human rights abuses. Yep. So yeah, there is a very small constituency for the Chinese Communist Party in Canada, and it's not going to win you a lot of votes. The problem from the Liberals' perspective is not only do they their own internal members, many of who are wedded to a pro-China view, but also the business community.
But I mean, I could see it also as like there's going to be a backlash in a lot of expatriate Hong Kong voters in Canada that are large numbers of constituents in many ridings, especially in BC. Yes. Now, I don't think the Liberals really have many seats to lose in BC right now. I don't think so. Am I way?
Well, they might have Vancouver South. Let me check. So Vancouver South is a Liberal seat and has a very important Hong Kong community there.
Yeah. I would say most of Vancouver, Greater Vancouver area.
Yeah.
That whole lower mainland, there's quite a large Hong Kong vote.
So yeah, so this will be a skill in Charybdis for the Liberals to navigate. So then, Jared, let me end off our discussion of the Conservative Party by I'm going to give you the four campaign slogans of the candidates, and I want you to guess who they are. I'm going to give you all four of them so that there's no process of elimination and you have to kind of match in advance, okay?
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, so number one, courage, compassion, common sense.
Okay.
Number two, unite, build, lead.
Oh, geez.
Number three, take back Canada.
Okay.
Number four, conservative, period, without apology.
Ooh, these are all nonsensical platitudes here. Oh gosh. Okay, this is going to be embarrassing how wrong I get all of these, I think. Okay, my first guess, I'm going to say conservative, period, without apology. I'm going to say that's Derek Sloan.
Okay, keep going. You gotta get them all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right. Unite, build, lead. Let's say Leslyn Lewis, and then let's go courage, compassion, common sense. Sorry, no. You know what? Let's go courage, compassion, common sense. Leslyn Lewis, unite, build, lead. Peter McKay, take back Canada. Aaron O'Toole.
Four for four, Jared.
Oh yeah, nice.
Very good.
Wow.
That's very good.
I'm impressed with myself right now.
Because of course I know the list. So, but I'm guessing I would have had a hard time take back Canada versus conservative without apology. I would have had a hard time guessing between Aaron O'Toole and Leslyn Lewis. For me, the unite build lead was a clear Peter McKay one.
Yeah. Just because he united the Conservative Party, that seemed like a nod back to that. Yeah. But actually what I think having punctuation in your tagline just seemed tacky. And so I thought that had to be Derek's.
Good. That was good. Good inference. So then let's just quickly touch on, or let me just kind of give a quick summary of my thoughts of the Green Party debate. And it really, which happened within the last couple of weeks, there's 9 candidates in the Green Party that are running. So that's first an interesting difference, which is the Conservative Party, which has hundreds of MPs and MPPs, and local constituencies across the entire country, all they could find was basically 4 people, 2 of which are non-entities to run, whereas the Green Party got 9. So
yeah, that's a crowded field.
Yeah, that's a crowded field for the Green Party. For the debate that happened on TVO, they split it into 2 groups of 5, hosted by Steve Paikin.
Wait, two groups of five? Isn't there nine? Debate. No, but it wouldn't have been 5 and 4?
Oh, yes. Okay. Sorry, 5 and 4.
Okay.
Yeah, so what I thought was interesting about the debate was a few of the questions that they asked and the responses that they got. So the first question that Steve asked all of the candidates was, and I'm paraphrasing here, like, does the left-right distinction really matter for the Green Party, or do you play by like a different political compass? And there were 3 types of answers that the Green Party candidates give. The one was, oh yeah, no, left-right, that's outdated. We don't work by those rules anymore, but we're the most progressive party in Canada. They're basically saying like, yeah, no, we're a left-wing party, but like let's score some points for being non-ideological. That's kind of the implication. Then the second one was, it's like, no, of course we're a left-wing party. That, for example, is candidate Miriam Haddad, who said, no, I'm a socialist, so we need to be the most left-wing party out there. And then there was one prominent voice in sort of another kind of opinion, which is actually, you know, we need to win vote from the center or even the center-right. So candidate Andrew West explicitly said, we need to have conservatives vote for us. And that is quite interesting because for 2 reasons. The first is that, as Andrew and some of the other candidates pointed out who are more aligned with this view, it's just that the left is a very crowded field in Canada's election. So you already have an explicitly left-wing socialist party of the NDP. You have the Liberals, who are able to swing as left as they need to win the election. And now you have the Green Party, which, if it's also the most progressive party, you're in trouble. And so Aaron O'Toole's riding in Durham is quite instructive, where in the last election, he won 45% of the vote, which was a comfortable margin above the Liberals of around 35. But if you do the math, the other ones went to the Greens and the NDP. And so there was if you want to make the claim, a 55% left-wing majority to overtake them. So now this is questionable if all Liberal voters are left. But the bottom line is, I think that was a good point. So, but there is a difference in candidates' views about what the Green Party is, just in terms of the political compass. Yeah.
I recognize the like political strategy behind that standpoint, but I kind of feel like the disingenuousness behind, like, why are you in a political party then? Shouldn't the political party more believe what it thinks is right? And then try and put that forward, not we'll just believe whatever is most popular.
Like, so conservative without apology? Is that what you mean?
I guess in a sense, yeah, that is like the most honest slogan that was of the 4. I wonder if there isn't like a number of people that would be turned off by that kind of sentiment.
But let me again put the other way, which is that, like, in the same way that I was trying to give examples of how you could be both conservative and get carbon reductions, you can also be green and court Tory voters if you're willing to not indulge in all of like your left-wing fantasies. Like, for example, again, I'm coming up with this in 30 seconds, but like I've got it from roughly what I've heard, like kind of the Green Party theories I've heard around the world, which is that, like, you know, we're not just about conserving the environment. We're like about like having sustainable government. And so there's a view of the Green Party, which is like, we don't want to run deficits. We don't want to like have like reckless government spending for like stupid projects, right? Like we think that we should have like a sustainability in our finances and sustainability in our environment. And that's how we can court Tory voters, right?
No, I don't think that that's wrong if that's like what you believe is right form of government. But what he said was, we need to have conservative platform because that's where the votes are. Not
no, he
because
said
that's
we
what
need
we
to
think
win
is
over
right.
Some conservative voters. right? Like if our only strategy is to be exclusively, like, basically taking left-wing voters, right? Like, if the generous interpretation, which I'm more sympathetic to, is that if our vision for the world is only one, that the only way to be sustainable environmentally is by having policies that are basically feel good for people on Vancouver Island, then we're not going to be a viable party. And there's nothing intrinsic about the Green Party that means that you can't have policies that might be considered conservative as long as those policies are in accordance with environmental sustainability, right?
If that's what the belief system of the party is, right? Like, I think you should be putting forward the belief system and say, we think that this is the right way for government to be formed. And then people will vote for you because they agree that you're correct. Not saying, we think this is where the most people think that we should be, and that's what we should make our policies then. That seems kind of backwards to me. Like, maybe that's just my own weird sensibilities that are getting in the mix, but
I agree. And I don't think that's what he was saying. I think at its purest form, and I'm not an expert on the Green Party, they're the least I know about in Canadian politics, but I think what he was saying, and I think this is true, and I think it's true, protecting the environment, there are certain things that are necessarily left-wing about that, and that it requires state action, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But other than a few things, there is no reason why a Green Party needs to be a left-wing party on other platform issues. And I sense that he believed the other things that he was saying. I just wanted to bring that out there as a general point, which is that in some countries, the Green Party is not necessarily a party of the left. But in Canada, the overwhelming number of candidates made it clear that the Green Party will continue to be a party of the left. So that's just an interesting development and something to keep note of.
I guess that must probably be stemming from just Canadians' perspective on Elizabeth May, right? And a lot of the things that she had kind of touted were seen as far left, though she always did seem pretty sensible to me.
Yeah. I'll give you a laundry list of some of the things that showed up on the Green Party candidates. None of these would be espoused by the Conservative. So they're kind of a nice contrast of the kind of extremes. And yes, this is a left-wing party. So first was universal basic income, which, as far as I could tell, every candidate supported a UBI. So wow. That was interesting. So, and maybe we'll talk about that in a second. There was one candidate who supported a robot tax. So that seemed particularly goofy. There was references to a Green New Deal, a $20 minimum wage. And then there was a variety of, I grouped them together, defund the police, cut military spending, and BDS for boycott, divest, and sanction against Israel type of thing. So, but like, yeah. Basically kind of cut, divest is like kind of a common theme across different candidates. And then there was what you might call the goodies, the free goodies. There was free university, free pharmacare. I think there may have been a reference to childcare, but I'm not exactly sure. I think that's a provincial issue, so I might be misremembering that. But yeah, so for the UBI, I thought that was quite interesting, especially now that we've had the CREB in Canada, which has basically been a temporary UBI. Jared, I don't know, do you think that there's anything that other parties could learn from the traction the UBI has gotten in the Green Party?
I think the UBI is a very interesting notion. Can the other parties adopt it? I don't think so because of the stigma around it. I think most people have heard of the UBI and then their opinions have been formed from the talk radio, from Republicans, from the Democrats talking about it. Because Andrew Yang was even such a big figurehead, because that was basically his whole platform was a UBI. And so I think there's already been a bit of a partisan split about it, where if you identify yourself as more right wing, then you're just against it, and more left wing, then you're for it. Any party where most of their members just identify left wing, they're just going to automatically be in favor of that. I mean, I think that's more just evidence, like you said, the Green Party is really a left party. Those candidates that were saying the Green Party is a left party, I'm a left leadership candidate, they were right.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. The one thing, again, like climate change, you know, there is a conservative way to do UBI. And one of the most prominent I don't know if activist is the right word, but like thought leaders on the UBI in Canada is Hugh Siegel, who's a senator and is a conservative and has been fighting for the UBI in Canada for decades now. And the conservative version of the UBI is that the UBI is a way to replace bureaucracy with a simple formula. So we take the bureaucrat out and we remove like a hodgepodge of ineffective programs with one simple UBI. The left does not want to cut other programs because of the UBI. But for the conservatives, you can say, we're going to get rid of unemployment insurance. We're going to get rid of these welfare payments and those welfare payments. And we're just going to have one UBI and that's it. And we're going to be able to fire 50,000 bureaucrats who administer all of these things, right? I think it's kind of a shame because I really think that there could be, I would prefer there to be a left-wing UBI and a right-wing UBI and the conservatives to kind of try to kind of put the liberals in a bit of a bind there.
I agree with you in that I think the most people in the Conservative Party, if the UBI wasn't already stigmatized, would have been for it. I would even say, yes, in conservative thought, there is like the small state, the laissez-faire, they would be in favor of cutting all those other benefits and keeping the UBI. But I think like actually a lot of right-wing voters would even like that UBI on top of the EI and everything. Many people actually do want more benefits. And that is really, I think people on the right just tend to favor tax cuts over more benefits. And so they vote conservative, whereas people on the left tend to favor more benefits over tax cuts. And so they vote on the left. But nobody really wants the benefits to get taken away ever. And nobody really wants the taxes to go up ever.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the classic case of voters want more government for themselves and less government for everyone else, right? Like they're conservative.
They want more government for themselves and not pay for it.
Yeah. They're conservatives in general, but like socialist in specific, I think is one way of putting it, I think. But yeah, so it's too bad. The UBI is completely dead on arrival in the current conservative environment. Although I think it has a slightly better chance of being adopted than a carbon tax, frankly. That is not
saying
much.
About almost everything.
Yeah, it's almost, yeah. But if only because it's quite easy to spin a conservative version of it if you explicitly talk about getting rid of EI, firing bureaucrats, and basically saying like getting the government out of your decision making. Like who's a social service worker to tell you that, you know, like you're not looking for a job hard enough, or that, you know, you shouldn't be spending this money on this thing. Just get the government out of your way. They're going to give you a check. And then on top of that, you say like the left says, if we just gave people enough money, like all our problems would go away. And we'd say like, look, we don't think all the problems are going to go away, but I think this is the minimum role that government should have. And then all these left-wing folks can see that it doesn't matter how much money we give people, it's not really going to solve poverty, but it could help to ameliorate it. And that should be the conservative view.
Now, wasn't the carbon tax the conservative approach to tackling climate change? Because it's like, this is a very simple approach. There's very little bureaucracy. Everyone can decide for themselves how they're going to change their lives to cut down on carbon. But now it's an unthinkable thing to say as a conservative. So we're just par for the course for ideas that could be conservative that are just not right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I thought these were some of the interesting things that showed up in the Green Party. One other interesting thing that I'm sure most people who are even politically attuned would not have picked up in the Green Party debate, in a back and forth between the one candidate, Andrew West, the one who said we need to win some Tory votes, and another candidate named Dimitri Lascaris, about basically running budget deficits, Lascaris said, we don't need to worry about running budget deficits in Canada. And basically the Bank of Canada should monetize the debt and the deficits. Basically, in a wealthy industrialized country with a large savings base, there will never be inflation. And he was espousing this theory known as MMT, modern monetary theory, which unsympathetically is a kooky left-wing idea that's come out of some American socialist economists that have advised Bernie Sanders, among others. And anyways, it was like, it was almost verbatim from what I've heard other MMT folks say. So this American new theory of how the money supply impacts price level has come north to Canada, and now some candidates are openly advocating for the Bank of Canada to monetize the debt and the deficit. So not that this candidate is likely to become the leader, but in the same way we noted that Derek Sloan has broken certain sound barriers in terms of what was acceptable to say before, there are now some candidates that are openly espousing Zimbabwe-style monetary policy. So I thought that was interesting.
That didn't work out so good.
No.
You can't even argue that that was like, oh, well, that was back in the 90s and 2000s that Zimbabwe happened, because it's happening right now in Venezuela.
Yeah, and there is a nuance, and don't get me wrong, I think there are many ways that central banks can, quote, print money in a non-inflationary way. But monetary policy is technical and complicated, but this view is not.
Wait, before we move on from the Green Party, to summarize this, do you think any of them will have the leadership qualities that Elizabeth May had? Because that was really the Green Party's strength and how they were able to, A, get her elected and keep her seat, and then get three seats. They always outdid the other parties in terms of how favorable the views were of their leader, Elizabeth May. Did you think personally that any of them really kind of met that bar?
Well, there were two Green Party folks, Glenn Murray and David Murner, which are former politicians. Murray actually was a liberal and like quite senior. So a couple of them come across as like competent. They're kind of centrist, and what they were saying was, again, what I sensed was that they were going to kind of moderate their policies once they actually became the leader. So yeah, the bottom line is there were talented people. It wasn't a stage full of Cousin Lewis's and Derek Sloan's, although there were like some what you might call kooky activists that will maybe win a seat on Van Island. But other than that, no, I could imagine a couple people becoming the leader and maintaining the seat or gaining one or two, but I didn't hear any of them talking about radically reforming the Green Party. And bottom line is, unless the Green Party goes into a coalition on the condition that first past the post is replaced by proportional representation, and it goes without saying that every candidate in the Green Party supports that, the party has no viability in Canada.
There can be a catastrophic shift though, right? If you look at the Labour Party and its rise, I just know that there have been like dramatic shifts in the UK where it was always kind of a two-party system until one of those parties gets replaced.
In the UK, the Labour Party destroyed the Liberal Party. So that's what happened. And that would have been, well, obviously by 1946, the Liberal Party had been eviscerated off the map.
Okay. So it was in the 40s that it had finally kind of solidified.
It might have even happened before. But definitely when Labour beat Churchill in that famous election. Actually, that might have been 45. I can't remember. But yeah. So of course these things can change over many decades, but not for the foreseeable future, I don't think. Yeah. So what you're talking about is the Green Party basically cannibalizing the NDP's vote and becoming.
I don't think that is necessarily even the NDP's vote. They could replace the Liberals, right? If someone very centrist in the Green Party, maybe this Bill Murray or this Andrew West wins, they could become very centrist. They could cannibalize the Liberal and Conservative votes, or take away those away. I don't necessarily like cannibalize. And the NDP could become the hard left party. Conceivably, that could happen. It seems unlikely, but it could happen.
Yeah, I agree. It could happen. I'm very skeptical that the Liberals vote for the Green Party.
I think we almost saw that happen with Jack Layton. It was NDP, where they were the official opposition over the Liberals, but really it was the kind of fame of Justin Trudeau and the passing of Jack Layton that I think relegated the NDP back to their previous position. Otherwise, they could have been the new Liberal Party.
My sense is that voters who would vote between the Liberals and the Green Party are low information voters. That is, that they have vaguely left-wing views. They're probably actually younger, maybe, but that they don't really care that much. Because for a party that basically supports the dissolution of NATO, like people who actually are in favor of the liberal worldview, like, they're not peaceniks. Like, they're not.
Was that a common theme across all the leaders, though?
No, I didn't. I don't remember them specifically talking about NATO, but basically defunding the military and the police. That was. And Elizabeth May has, I mean, she denies it on depending on the hour you ask her, but has basically said that they want to abolish NATO. So like, this is just not a, this is not a, a thing that's going to win over serious like middle class voters in the suburbs, right?
Fair enough.
So I the Green Party is not going to be a force on the national stage from what I've seen so far. But yeah, if one of those more seasoned politicians gets elected and maybe comes up with an interesting electoral strategy, I mean, we'll see. And again, I feel bad for the Green Party because they didn't, that referendum in BC failed that would have gotten proportional representation. And I think they could have really proved that would have been powerful. And so they've had bad luck for the Green Party in Canada, bad luck. So Jared, there was one other thing I wanted to talk about, Huawei explicitly, not necessarily in the Canadian context. So within the last week, the UK government flip-flopped their position on whether or not Huawei would be allowed in the 5G network. And by 2027 now, all Huawei equipment must be taken out of UK's wireless network. This is a huge blow to UK, to Sino-UK relations, and now means that of the Five Eyes countries, so the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, three have now explicitly banned Huawei. New Zealand policy is that they have an independent telecoms regulator that makes decisions on these choices, but it looked like it's going to be probably hostile to Huawei. And Canada remains the only country to have no official policy on whether Huawei will be allowed in the 5G network, but the Liberals have said that they're going to make a decision by the end of this year. So with the UK development, this further limits the Liberals' options in terms of having some sort of political escape hatch.
I think they're going to wait it out as long as they possibly can. They've given themselves this timeline, I guess, of the end of the year. That's a long time in politics. In my mind, I hope why the UK really made this decision was they had an independent cybersecurity, I can't remember what the word was that they put it together, as like a review board. That they had kind of put together to basically investigate if they could trust the Huawei equipment. And one of the things that actually came out of that was that they found there was too many bugs in the Huawei equipment that they could really say that they could trust it or even get their tests done properly. And so in my mind, if that was a main reason for why Boris Johnson decided to ban it, that seems very legitimate to me. Looking at a lot of the headlines, though, it seems like the UK has almost officially said that it was because Trump pressured them into dropping it.
There's one thing, though, that is US related, but is also valid on just a technical point about the equipment, which the US has banned US basically chips or like microchip technology from going into Huawei equipment. So the previous reviews that the UK, whatever it is, the advisory board that you'd mentioned had done was on the assumption that it would be using American technology, some of the components. And now there's a question mark over what Huawei is going to be replacing that with. So there are further, because of the US action, there's further question marks about the reliability of the equipment.
That kind of like raises a red flag around why the UK did ban this. I'm not happy about China's foreign policy stance. And I think there's a lot of things that they've done, especially recently with the Uyghurs, with Hong Kong, even with the pressure that they put on us that we've already talked about with Meng Wanzhou, taking the two Michaels as hostages.
And the tariffs on our agricultural crops too.
And yeah, the tariffs on our canola oil. No, it's true. Those are all aggressive, belligerent actions that aren't really justified in any kind of an international order in my mind. But I think if we want there to be an international order, we need to stand by those rules on each case by case. If we're going to ban Huawei, we need to have some kind of a formal justification as to why. And that needs to be the solid underpinning of it. Because if we're not following by the rules we want everyone to follow by, we're not going to get them to follow them. I guess I'm a bit disheartened that the UK had to make this decision because of political interference from the United States, instead of maybe they could have said, let's do a temporary ban and let's do a check on all of the technology that's coming through. Like, how can we guarantee that Huawei puts the utmost security in their systems, that there's no backdoors? And then if there is no way that Huawei can prove it, then maybe we can move forward with a ban. But this seems like it was too political of a decision, too arbitrary to me.
I think that's a really good point. Let me disagree with part of it, but let me first talk about the points I agree with it. So in the same way that we had a really good defense of saying it's like, look, we really didn't want to arrest Meng Wanzhou, but like we have an extradition treaty with the U.S. and we received a valid request. And yep. So we have to follow the rule of law in the country and enact this, yep. right? And I think that's a really good point. And similarly, you could argue the New Zealanders have a good point too about, well, we're not explicitly making a decision about Huawei. We're going to let this independent agency decide on a case-by-case basis. And that's a really good point. And I think we should do that. That seems more reasonable. But there are also just, there are some decisions which need to be made by political decision makers. So, you know, like you could have an independent agency which says like, we think the risks are limited, but we can't, there's no, it's not black and white. This is our best assessment of it, but you still need to make the call. And so there's right. always going to be that certain level of uncertainty. And then that's where parties that basically say like, I don't want a country whose foreign policies is fundamentally divergent with our values to basically be supported or subsidized by us. And I think there's a legitimate thing for non-economic, non-technical reasons for making these political decisions at the end of the day. Not that in this case is that we got to that point where we had done the best we could at an independent and procedural level and then come to that decision. I agree. This is just overtly political kind of from the start. Yeah. But even if it was, I think there's still room for political decision making.
I agree with you. Yeah, there has to even be some kind of a political level, because even if you go with the technical thing and then the technical people can say, well, we think there's a 99% chance that it's going to be safe. You as a politician have to make the decision on that threshold of probability of it not being safe that you're willing to take for the Canadian people. But I think there's a better way to do it in that you say, before we even go under this investigation, as soon as the United States have come out with this Huawei thing, if Justin Trudeau or whoever in this hypothetical had been the Canadian Prime Minister had come out and then said, look, we think that if there is any chance that the Huawei equipment can be corruptible, then we will not accept it in our telecoms. And I will now defer that, proving that, to our expert board. Then the expert board goes away, comes back and says, no, look, this was the decision we came up with. They can't do this for us. Then you can do that. And that seems like a more legitimate, more easy to foresee the types of decisions and like why people did these decisions. Now, that being said, that's like almost impossible to do because you have to have that kind of foresight, be on top of everything and all crises at once.
But Jared, I like that you brought statistics into this, that you brought a decision theoretic mapping of probabilities to binary outcomes. That was really good. And I like that you mentioned
working as a data scientist with you now. So I have to.
And I like that you mentioned 99%. So I just looked up this quote. Because what you just implied there was a 1% doctrine, which Dick Cheney already established back in whenever that was, 2003 or 5.
Well,
quote,
time ago, I guess,
this is Dick Cheney. If there's a 1% chance that Pakistani scientists are helping Al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. It's not about our analysis. It's about our response. So... there's
so
Cheney's 1% doctrine.
Dick Cheney?
Well, I'm just saying Cheney drew it.
I gotta rethink my life.
Cheney drew the 1% threshold, so 1% sensitivity, but that's fine. Kind of got a little off topic there, but just to kind of get back to Huawei, just it's worth reflecting on how bad Chinese relations are with all of the major English-speaking countries right now. So David Cameron in the UK, so going back throughout conservative history, David Cameron was considered very pro-Chinese. He brought in their foreign investment to help like refurbish nuclear reactors and basically said Britain was open up for business. That has slowly shifted over time. And so now Boris Johnson is definitely the most anti-China conservative leader, although nowhere near as anti-China as Canadian leaders are. But just to put this in perspective, just because the UK is so much more dependent on Asia now that there's Brexit and whatnot, but things are basically now on the downward because of the UK's decision, and China has come out with the usual set of responses saying this is anti-Chinese, like, you know, there will be consequences, blah, 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 the usual thing they do. So we'll see what happens with that. The well, obviously the worst relations that China has is with the United States right now, where there's an active trade war going on, and the Trump administration is waging an all-out, basically mercantilist and focusing on corporations. Ironically, Trump is acting like China, which he's focusing on specific companies and threatening them. And so basically China is getting a Chinese response. And so
it's
there's
tit for tat response.
Tit for tat. Yeah. The same playbook.
Even though they had kind of declared a ceasefire, I thought, because the Chinese had agreed, we're going to just buy some number of goods from the U.S. And because Trump thinks that's how trade works and that he would win if that was what happened, then he agreed to it. Though it seems like the Chinese are way off on making those targets and probably won't even try to. They're just going to bank on Biden winning, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, ceasefires are what they sound like. They're a ceasefire. They're not permanent. They're not a...
This is true. They're still at war.
They're still at war. But the point is that the U.S. and China are probably have their worst relations since Nixon went to China in 1972. Yeah. And on top of that, beyond just the trade war, I mean, recently in the last couple of months, I remember reading stories about the NIH has fired 54 scientists because of non-disclosed foreign ties, the majority of which were to China. So like they're cracking down on researchers. There's all sorts of things the US is doing. Now, the more relevant case for Canada is Australia. The UK has very unique kind of circumstances with Brexit, and they don't have a history of anti-China sentiment. So they're generally probably the most pro-China, and the US is its own thing. But Australia is roughly the same size as Canada, roughly the same political mentality, similar type of parties that they have there. But they are much more, there's much more public awareness of China's threat to their, or perceived threat, depending on your opinion, to their national security. So, you know, there are debates, there are panels that get held in Australia with politicians joining about like, what is China's threat to our political institutions, right? Like, we are nowhere near in Canada where cross-party talks are happening on China's threat to our country, sort of thing like that. So they're much more sensitive of that in Australia. They've banned money from China to political parties. They've arrested and indicted Australian politicians for basically receiving bribes from various Chinese businessmen or whatever the sources are originally. And currently China has various economic sanctions against Australia, against their cattle, so for meat and certain agricultural crops, and the government has basically told Chinese students not to study in Australia. So they have a much more antagonistic relationship currently. This is all to say is that when you look at the spectrum, is China is trying to do a kind of a divide and rule strategy, picking off one country at a time. But if China has active disagreements with all English-speaking wealthy nations currently, it seems like there would be an opportunity for a united front to kind of push back against China, right? For divide and rule to work, you cannot be at war with all the parties you're seeking to divide.
Well, I think China isn't necessarily really trying to like divide and conquer all the English-speaking nations. This is just the diplomacy it's been doing all this time. It's just it hasn't had the economic clout to actually do it to a Western nation before now. These were kind of similar tactics, I think, that they were doing a lot in like Southeast Asia, bribing various politicians, basically using these sanctions against all these different Southeast Asian nations in order to kind of bully their way through those politics down there. I think it's more just the English world is waking up to how China has just always done foreign policy.
Yeah, but my view is that it's not going to be an effective foreign policy for China. So like,
I agree with you there.
Yeah. I mean, just again, pretending I'm pro China here. Like if your major companies are getting banned from the largest markets in the world, like that's not a good thing.
I guess I worry though, that it will like divide the nations because Huawei hasn't really been banned by any emerging economies. If China is able to do these politics and they don't necessarily really work on these Western nations because we have alternatives, we can spend a little bit of extra money and buy from Ericsson or Nokia or wait a little longer to get 5G, But if you're talking about someplace like Africa, then they are not going to be able to wait that long to get 5G because they don't have 4G implemented for everyone, and 5G was supposed to be a solution maybe, or the bribes and the corruption, there's not really a strong enough governmental institution in order to root it out and prevent it. This can really divide the world into two different camps. Those in the West who were able to prevent Huawei basically coming in, and those that were unwilling to or unable to. And if those systems then kind of diverge, we can end up in this real Cold War again, except in a kind of business front. And now it's no longer about political ideologies, it's about national identities.
Yeah, I could definitely see that sort of split, the aligned, like, which, who are you aligned with? Are you aligned with the China world order, the US world order emerging? But just again, just on a strategic point, which is that there are points where empires make bad geostrategic decisions, and they can say, you know, honestly, we're so powerful and we have so many other markets that, like, yeah, this is bad for us, but, like, you know, it's still going to be a very powerful company. This is a bad way to think, because there are always moments, though, where when you're in the downswing and you desperately wish you had have had those troops, so, or that those resources, sorry, I'm thinking in military terms, there are all sorts of situations where it's like, take the Nazis invading Russia, and it's like, you know, maybe we should have actually, like, had a treaty with Japan to make sure that they didn't sign a peace treaty with the Soviet Union. But, you know, like, we're conquering all of Europe right now, so, like, we don't really need to worry. It's like, yeah, but that Pacific division ended up being the one that prevented you from taking Moscow. So, you know, like, at the end of the day, every resource matters, right? When you're trying to exercise influence, and if you're sloppy about it, then your power will eventually be dissipated. I don't want China's world order to win, so I'm happy that they're making bad diplomatic choices. But on the other hand, it just goes to show you how, I guess, ideology and history can override, like, real politique on some level, I guess.
Yeah, you're right. I think we just have to wait and see if this slight strategic oversight from China is going to have the same kind of consequences as the slight strategic oversight the Nazis had with Japan, I guess.
And let me give you the, to bring this to an actual example that could matter for China, what I mean by, I was speaking vaguely there, is what happens if China actually has a financial crisis? The one that has never happened, but many people have predicted could happen, given the huge amount of complicated debt structures that exist there, and they need a bailout or they need resources, and they have basically antagonized the English-speaking countries, which, oh, by the way, happen to have where all the world's debt markets and, like, the largest financial exchanges are, right? Like, I, you know, like, this is why, like, bad diplomatic decisions can, when you are vulnerable, end up, like, hurting you. In China's case.
Yeah, that's true. But that's also why they want to push their own, like, transfer system for monetary transfers worldwide, and replacing SWIFT, the SWIFT system. That's why they want to replace that. They want to weaken the dollar's place as, you know, the global currency of exchange. They want to basically get a stronger hold on Hong Kong because it's also a global financial market. And so if they can have the same political influence in there as they do on other state-owned enterprises, then that would really shore them up. I think there might be alternatives, and maybe we are overestimating how much China would need the West in a crisis. And that might be the calculation that they have made, that they don't need the West if there is a crisis.
Well, they haven't really had an economic crisis.
Not yet.
So we'll see when that happens.
It's been an interesting past 5 years at all moments. Ever since even Trump got elected, there's been a lot of what you might call inflection points, it seems, in the history of the world. But I think 2020 is turning out to be the strongest inflection point, with kind of a lot of things all coming to a head at the same time, where we have this global pandemic, the end of Donald Trump's presidency, and a belligerent China all happening at once. This year will be really important to watch.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That kind of thinking about how now is related to this big change we've seen since Trump or whatever, or Trump, Brexit, that whatever you want to call that inflection point that kind of really took off 5 years ago. The one thing that you just said there that reminded me is that what we're seeing in Canadian politics right now, hence to your point, is that almost all the issues we discussed are really ones of a global nature. So ironically, the Conservative Party is becoming much more nationalistic, but it's in response to international things. So the carbon, the kind of the focus against the carbon tax is really a slight against Paris and the kind of the international movement of, to fight climate change. There's the various debates about China and their foreign policy and whether we want to keep aligning ourselves to the United States and issues of trade. And Huawei. So all of these things are very much external one way or the other and not about fundamentally internal issues to Canada, which historically might have been things about same-sex marriage or euthanasia or reconciliation with First Nations. Right.
All of these are fun. Marijuana,
legalization of marijuana, right? Marginal income tax rates. I don't know. Right. Right. Like these are all the kind of the big salient and important issues, at least in the Conservatives and probably for the other parties too, tend to be international directly or indirectly.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, we'll call it an end to the sixth episode of the Statistically Insignificant podcast. So Jared, thank you for all of your interesting insights today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be co-hosting here with you.
This is fun.
For the sixth time, I guess.
This is good. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.